Hey guys, just wanted to give you a quick heads up that there's some adult content later in this episode. Just some drug references, but if you're listening with some little ones, you might want to save it for later or pop in some earbuds. Cool, here's the show.
Let me tell you the truth. Keep it on the down low, keep it on the down low. Get on down to the down low.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Down Low Podcast. I'm Laura Chanette. I know it's been a minute since you've heard from me, and I'm sorry that I left you hanging. But full disclosure, my computer crashed after its most recent update, and everything is sorted, and now we're back on track, and I won't do that to you again. Here in Telluride, we're just coming out of spring off season, which is when tourism dips between the closing of the ski resort and the start of our summer festivals. Many of the restaurants and businesses close for a couple weeks, which for some folks means setting off to adventure, hitting up the river, going out to the desert, mountain biking, climbing. Some keep chasing powder. But if you're like me, you're celebrating the onset of warm weather and summer sports. Other folks hopefully found a little extra peace and quiet to get some work done. Well, for those few weeks, our tiny town felt a little tinier. Whatever you did, I hope it was restorative. This project was actually conceived a few years ago during a spring off season when my wife and I were adventuring in our 1984 Westphalia, which is painted like a zebra, by the way. And we were driving up the West Coast to visit family and friends. And along the way, we were listening to countless storytelling podcasts. And we just really loved the conversations and the stories that they inspired between us. Then we began to toss around this idea of bringing a project like that to Telluride, because this community is already so rooted in storytelling. If you've never been here, it's hard to walk two blocks without running into someone and sharing a story about what you did that weekend or how your family's doing. At the same time, there's lots of people that you may pass on the street every day and be familiar with, but maybe you haven't taken the time to share a story. So in 2014, we partnered with our friends at Telluride Theater and put together our very first live event at a bar in town. The theme was family and holidays, which we figured would be accessible enough. Our general goal was to find people who might not always be inclined to get on stage to come and share something. Since then, we've held over 25 live events at venues all over town. Then when Telluride Magazine came to us and offered to help make our dream of turning it into a podcast come true, we were so excited. And here we are at episode 3. The theme for this show is help. I need somebody. Thanks to everyone who helped us get here. Our first story comes from Harold Mintz, told at one of our live download events themed Taking It to the Limit. Here in Telluride, we first grew familiar with Harold's story when he came to the Mountain Film Festival back in 2016 with his film 1-800-GIVE-US-YOUR-KIDNEY. When he returned to the festival in 2017, he was kind enough to share this story on stage. He regularly advocates for everyone to become organ donors. So, if you're inspired and you haven't yet, feel free to pause this podcast and sign the back of your driver's license. Here's Harold's story.
So let's start with the end of the story first. The end of the story is 16 years ago, I was at Georgetown University Hospital, where a team of surgeons cut me open, took out my left kidney, put it in a beer cooler filled with ice. They put that beer cooler, put it in the backseat of someone's car, where they drove it across the Potomac River into Virginia to a different hospital, where another team of transplant surgeons put my left kidney inside of someone I didn't know and had never met before. And so what we get to talk about for the next 9 minutes is why somebody would wake up one day and start giving out body parts to strangers. Now, I'll cut to the chase. Nobody does that. Nobody wakes up one day and says, you know what I'm going to do today? Here. The way I always explain it to people is a series of events. I used to call them dominoes. One hit another, caused another one to fall. But now I've changed that a little bit, and I call it breadcrumbs. You put enough breadcrumbs on that scale, and eventually, those breadcrumbs are like this. They're nothing. They're tiny, small little things. They're insignificant. But when enough of those get on the scale, eventually that scale tips. And when it's tipped for me, I started asking questions. So, real quickly, here's some of the breadcrumbs. I'm in high school. Teacher says, do we have an assembly today? Now, remember high school assemblies? That's good shit, right? Because you don't have to go to math class or whatever it is. So I was psyched. And so We go down, and instead of in the auditorium, this particular assembly was in our cafeteria, which was odd. The doors of the cafeteria open up, and instead of, you know, a riser and people that think they can play music, it wasn't that. It was people laying down on couches and beds doing this. What were they doing? Yeah, they were giving blood. So we looked at my teacher and went, okay, hang on. This is absolutely not an assembly. This is needles and blood and ew. And he says, well, you don't have to do this. You can go to study hall if you don't want to come to the... I gave blood for the first time in my life that day. So, well, it wasn't because I was a nice guy. Let's make sure we understand here. Because people hear, oh, guy gave kidney to stranger. What a nice guy. It's not really that, it's not that straight of a line. I gave blood the first time because I got out of math class. I got to lay down for 20 minutes. And Donna Carter. You're laughing like you know. Donna Carter was the captain of the cheerleaders when I was in high school, and she was giving cupcakes to everybody who gave blood that day. Holy shit, I'll give blood every day, laying down, no math, and cupcakes. It's good. Okay, so I gave blood and decided that didn't hurt so bad, and I felt good after doing it. Great, breadcrumb. Insignificant, but there it is. A few years later, I get out of high school, I'm in college. I'm a freshman in college, and I get back from... in December, the first time coming home for Christmas break, I'm the middle of three sons. I have an older brother and a younger brother. And we're all together for the first time. And at the dinner table that first night, my dad said, I'm sick. Unrelated to kidneys or anything like that. He said he had something cancer-related to his spleen. But don't worry, all they have to do is remove my spleen and everything will be great. Freaking out a little bit, but okay. So 2 days later, we were at the hospital. And just like in the movies, the doctor says it'll only be 3 hours. And in 4 hours, you know, it's already overdue, the doctor comes out wearing those scrubs and that swinging door thing opens up, and he comes out and says, we can't stop his bleeding. Holy shit, you were just supposed to take out a spleen. He's not supposed to not wake up. Well, again, making a long and relatively painful story short, for this evening, they plugged him up, they managed to stop the bleeding, but he passed about 5 weeks later. So from the day he found out he was sick to the day he passed was about 5 weeks. Wow, so my family stood around afterwards, and I remember very distinctly a conversation I had with my brothers. Nobody likes when family passes, but we know the circle of life, right? Lion King, you're born, you have a family, you make a bunch of friends, and eventually that circle comes to a close. But my brothers and I looked at each other and we said, look, we could have been the wealthiest people in the D.C. area at the time, and it would have had absolutely zero effect on the outcome. Why? Because they didn't know how to fix them. It wasn't that we didn't have the money. It was we don't know how to fix that illness yet. Don't like it, but I understand it. Soon after that, I heard a statistic. Every day, 22 people, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, this row and a half here dies every day waiting for a kidney. They know exactly what to do to fix these people. I don't want to say it's easy surgery because I couldn't do it, but they do it all the time. You're O positive, they go, okay, hang on. They go here, they get an O positive kidney. Oh, sorry, we're out O positives, and they say, come back tomorrow. And you go, I don't have tomorrow, I need it today. 22 times a day, people die from that. And when you can't fix dad and we don't know how to, okay. But if my dad was going to die from something they knew how to fix and they just didn't have parts, yeah, that was a heavier breadcrumb for me, so that tilted a little bit. Okay, so now I read a newspaper article, Washington Post. High school teacher donates kidney to save student's life. Holy shit. So I read that article, and the more detail I get, this teacher's white, student was black, and I kept thinking, first of all, I have no medical degree in me. I'm like, I didn't even know you could do that. And now I know on the inside, we're all pretty much the same other than blood types. It doesn't matter what religion or what color or, you know, ethnicity you are. It's all the same. and so I was just intrigued by it. Dink, just left a mark without even knowing it. I'm in a mall in New York City. My wife and I had just moved to New York for a job. It's Valentine's Day week. And we decided to go to the mall together. You're going to go that way down the mall and buy me a Valentine's Day present. And I'll go this way and buy you one and we'll meet back in an hour. Okay, so I walk down, and as I'm walking down, I see a table set up in the middle of the mall with a hand-painted poster on the front of it that says, please help us save our daughter's life. And there was I'll call them an elderly couple, but they probably look like this. And so it's New York, and look, I see it, and I'm there to buy flowers and chocolate. I don't want that kind of a bummer of a story. So I see him, and I walk by. Like, I don't even see him. And I hit past. And what is everybody else in this New York City mall doing? Exactly the same thing. So I make a U-turn, and I come back. And I go, what's up? Why are you here? And they tell me the story. Their daughter has leukemia. Again, unrelated to kidneys. But they said, we're asking people to give a little bit of blood at our church this weekend, because if she gets a bone marrow transplant, that sometimes does wonderful things for this type of leukemia. So I found my wife, and instead of chocolate and flowers that Valentine's Day, we sure enough, we went to their church, gave a little bit of blood, and we got tested. Flash forward 6 months, haven't heard anything from them. My wife and I decided New York doesn't fit. We don't want to stay there anymore. So we pack up. It's the day we're leaving New York. We lock up our rental house. The moving van had just left. And on the front stoop, I look down as we lock up the door, and there's the morning newspaper. I pick it up and I look at it, and there's a high school prom picture on the front of the newspaper. And I look at it for a second and go, I know her. And then it hit me. It's that girl who needed, you know, the bone marrow. Obviously, they didn't get it from my wife, right? But look at her. She's beautiful wearing that, you know, corsage and all that stuff. So I start reading the article, and of course, unfortunately, that's not what it was about. She had just passed away, but the parents were so thankful that so many neighbors had come forth to try to help her. They said, unfortunately, we couldn't save her, but because so many of you did this, somebody eventually is going to be saved by all that you did. I remember going, I'm tingling even now as I say that to you. These weren't statistics. These were people that I met who lost a kid. Doosh, doosh. Last one. I'm on a plane going from East Coast to West Coast. There's a movie on a plane. Not a great movie, but it's about a high school football player who can either continue to be the star of the football team or donate one of his kidneys to save grandma's life. It was Debbie Reynolds was the grandma, if anyone saw that. So I finished reading the book, started watching the movie, and at the end of the movie, as the credits are rolling, the very last thing on the screen says, for more information, call this number. 1-800-GIVE-US-YOUR-KIDNEY, at least. That's what I always say it was. It's not what it was. If you call 1-800-GIVE-US-YOUR-KIDNEY, you're going to get somebody try to sell you real estate, so don't call that number. And I wrote that number in the book, put it away, and then a few months later, as I was cleaning out my briefcase, that book opens up, and I see the phone number. Do I have 2 minutes? Someone give me a hint? Okay. So I see that, and what the hell? Saw the movie, can you send me information on organ donation? And sure enough, within 3 days, I get this in the mail. It's just packed, but it's all about how to donate after you're dead. So I call him back and said, not dead yet, thanks, got it all. If I want to donate now to somebody, what do we do? And at the time, you couldn't do it. That wasn't allowed, because if I wanted to give to somebody in Washington, they said, what happens if somebody in Texas is next on the list? It fought protocol. Give us your name and number. If it ever gets approved, we'll call you. Holy shit, a year later, my phone rings. Hey, is this the Harold Minson said he wanted to give his kidney to a stranger? I didn't say I want to do it. I just said I was curious about it. So I went in. It's in my scrapbook. I have this whole list of questions that I asked. And every time I asked a question, will I have to eat pills the rest of my life? Will there be serious scars? Can I still go bungee jumping? Can I, you know? And every answer they gave me was, well, that's cool. That doesn't freak me out. So that night I went home and my wife said, how was your day? She knows nothing about this concept at this point in time. I said, it's great. You know, I had a meeting. I had a hamburger for lunch. And, oh, I met with a psychiatrist to talk about giving my kidney to a stranger, which was the first thing they make you do. And she goes, you're so funny. I said, I know, but I really did this. Now she's not laughing anymore. Now she looks at me and goes, well, you're not serious, are you? And that was a red letter day for our family. That night, my wife and I don't think we've ever argued in 28 years. We had some serious conversation that night. And it got to the end where I finally said, look, you're smarter than me. You've always been much smarter than me. You said no before you asked one question. How about if you make 51% of this decision? I'll be 49. Just go through the process with me and ask the questions. And when we get to the point, if and by chance I even pass these tests, you can be 51%. I can't believe it, but she said okay. And then came a whole series of tests for about 3 months. And you said I was the first to donate, living donor. No, let's be right here. I'm one of the first who donated to someone he didn't know in one of these organized programs. So I can't take away anything from people I don't know about. So anyway, 3 months after surgery, if both donor and recipient agree, they'll let you meet. I'll leave you with this. I don't have an ounce of religion in me whatsoever. The person who received my kidney is the most religious person I've ever met. They're from Ethiopia. I'm from Virginia. She's this big. I'm this big. I talk like this. She talks like this. We're opposite in spiritual, in physical, in religious, in every possible way you can measure a person. Exact opposites. And yet, today, we are family. We are as close to being family as we can. All from tiny little breadcrumbs that at the time meant nothing. How many breadcrumbs have you placed on your scale today? You don't even know it, but you did. Thanks for being here. Yes.
That story was from Harold Mintz. Next up, we have a story from Landon Feller. He's a woodworker, and he also specializes in outdoor leadership. He currently resides in Ophir, Colorado. He had been talking for a long time about telling a story at the Down Low. He's one of those really good campfire storytellers, and I'd been bothering him for a long time to participate in one of our events. Finally, when the Family and Holidays edition rolled around in 2017, he decided he had a story to share. Just a quick note, the story was recorded live, and so as Landon's getting situated with the microphone, there's some muffled sounds here and there. But the story is still there, and it's still great, so hang tight. Here's Landon.
So I've been promising to stand up here for a really long time, and it was definitely time when I found that we were bringing back families and holidays. I have a family, and they celebrate holidays. Our poison is Christmas. But for me, it's the day after Christmas. It's Boxing Day, the 26th of December. Lo and behold, today. I don't think of it as a Boxing Day. I think of it as Adventure Day. I like to go out and do something I've never done, something scary, stand up on a stage and talk to people, for example. And I think this tradition for me goes back to 1995. There was a brand new movie, super scary, intense in theaters. It was called Jumanji. It's in theaters again this year. Incredibly tense, the suspense in this film. It opens up in the 1800s with these two boys. One of them's name is Caleb, and you know this because his name gets screamed. They're burying this drum-beating box. It says Jumanji on the cover. They're burying it because it's haunted. And anybody who plays this game inside this box gets wrapped up in this horrible nightmare, this waking nightmare. Well, in 1995, my older cousin Jordan and my little sister, Laura, she's 2 years younger, and Jordan's sister, Monica, who's my sister's age, all four of us had this newfound autonomy coming our way. And we didn't know it until we got to Abilene, Texas. That's where my grandfolks lived. We were all born and raised in Texas, and in that day and time, kids were seen, not heard, at least in my grandparents' house. And we didn't really do much without direct supervision. And so when I was 12 and I got to go to the Paramount Theater in Abilene, Texas, to see Jumanji with no parental supervision. I mean, this was cracking open an egg that had limitless potential, right? And we went, and, you know, here's this scene, and these kids are burying this box, and the boy falls in the hole, and the drum beats start coming out of the box, and he says, Caleb, pull me out! And then it cuts to Robin Williams. The thing wrapped up, and all this energy and suspense of this movie was just in our skin. We got picked up by the moms and taken back to Concord Circle, where the double lot, massive grandparents' homes, biggest home I knew about, might have been all of about 3,500 square feet. They dumped us there and they went back out shopping. So like the autonomy, it continued, you know. What should we do? Well, I've got this incredible desire for adventure now. Let's go on an adventure. So we headed out into the backyard and we explored all the way from the fire pit past the pecan trees, we got to Great Grand's clothesline, and this was the yard we'd known all our lives, and it wasn't that special, you know. We were looking for a bigger backyard, and it didn't take us long to head back there to the wall. Jordan and I peeked over the wall, and we saw things that we had never dared to look at before, because beyond the wall was a horrific scene. That's why the wall was there. Granddaddy had built that wall to keep people out of the creek. It was about a 30-degree incline through cat's claw and mesquite thorns and slick mud and rock down into this creek that was infested with water moccasins, hypodermic syringes, and knives. I know for a fact there were knives in here. So you didn't go back there unless you really wanted an adventure. And we did. And so we brought the sisters. We said, come on, this is a good idea. I called my sister to ask her recollections of this, because it's like 22 years ago. It's like, what do you remember about that day that we went beyond the wall? And my sister said, I'm pretty sure it was your idea. So over we went, and Jordan and I were in there, and we were starting to navigate through the mesquite. And the girls came over as well, because they weren't going to be left behind. They didn't want to go, but they weren't going to stay. And they just kind of clung to the wall, and we began traversing our way. And the full extent of this adventure, as it appeared in our minds, was, we'll just make it from one end to the other and not get killed. It'll be great. And so the girls are clinging to the wall, and Jordan and I are side-hilling on this slope. And, you know, anybody who spends much time in the mountains probably knows, like, when you're side-hilling, when you're traversing around a slope, the tendency is to descend. It's really hard to stay high, and that's what happened. And we got down close enough, and it sloped off steadily to the point that Jordan just stepped on the right rock, and it went. He was on his blue jeans sliding into the creek, and he landed about chest deep and began just scrambling back. And I remember him looking up at me and saying, Landon, help, pull me out. And I said, okay, cool, no problem. Glance back to see what the girls are doing, and they're like, Billy goes, boom, over the wall, gone. And then two heads kind of peek back up. They're not really screaming, they're just looking. And so I'm like, don't worry, Jordan, I got this. And I kind of work my way down and grab onto a mesquite trunk, reach out my other hand, and, you know, it's not going to work. And Jordan is flailing and just dragging at all the leaves and the sticks and the rocks, and everything's coming down around him. And slowly, the slope is just turning into a sluiceway. And I turned around to my sister and I said, Laura, go get help. And she looked at me for like another 10 seconds. I'm like, no, now. Go get help now. She's like 10, maybe. And she starts toddling off toward the house and goes inside. This autonomy thing, it was for real, apparently. All of the parents were gone. All the grandparents were gone. The only person in the house was great-granddaddy Joe Davis. He's a 93-year-old fossil. He's blind, he's half deaf, but thank God there is a genetic predisposition in my family. This is a strange thing, you're not going to believe me. But in my family, the way it works is if you want to sleep or take a nap and it's daylight out, you lay down on the couch and turn on a football game. And you're sleeping on the couch watching the football game. Like, that's technically true. Because as soon as somebody goes to switch the channel, you wake up and say, excuse me, I was watching that. So my little 10-year-old sister goes in there and sees deaf great-granddaddy Joe Davis sleeping on the couch, and she just reaches over and changes the channel, and he sits up, and it all works, right? What are you doing? What's wrong? Great-granddaddy Joe Davis, come quick. The boys are in the creek. And he sits up. He says, why are the boys in the creek? Well, they fell in. He says, oh. And he gets up. Now, there is something I want to tell you about this man. He might be ancient, but he was an incredible individual. He was ambidextrous. He was an amazing musician and artist. He raised a family of six in the tent cities of Texas during the big oil booms. He was just a roughnecker with all these amazing skills. And so, you know, if you're going to pick somebody to troubleshoot, he's not the worst that you could come up with. And so he says, okay, let's go. And he stands up, and this is our rescue party. We've got two 10-year-old girls and a 93-year-old man. While Laura has been going to get great-granddaddy Joe, Jordan and I have been troubleshooting this problem about being stuck in the creek. Because, you know, scratch and scrape as you might, you're not getting out of it, really. It's just too slick. And we think, we need something, a tool, like an ice axe. Because we're in Texas, and who doesn't have... Wait, Jordan, the day before, on Christmas Day, had received in his stocking one of the biggest Swiss Army knives you ever saw. And I said, Jordan, grab that Swiss Army knife you got. We'll open the blade, we'll drive it into the dirt, and we'll haul ourselves out. Or himself, because at this point, I wasn't in the water yet. And he says, you've got it. It's in your pocket. You've insisted on carrying it all day. Now, to my recollection, I opened it up and handed it to him gently, and he dropped it. When I called Jordan to ask about this story, he said, oh, yeah, no, you pulled it out of your pocket and tossed it underhand to me, like 5 feet over my head, and plunk, into the creek, gone. And I think his story might be true, because I do remember kind of looking at him after it was gone and him looking at me and me realizing there was really only one way to proceed, and I just hopped in. Sorry, I did that. The way I remember feeling was, well, I'm taller than Jordan. He was actually a year older than me, but I was always bigger and taller than him. And I thought, if I jumped in and pushed him out, maybe I could haul myself out. And neither of those things was true. And so there we were waiting on our rescue party. And as the slope got all slicked up, we kind of migrated upstream. You know, all the time in my head, I'm just like hearing these drums. Dum, 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 dum. It's like the snakes are coming. Something's coming. And we would migrate upstream a little bit, try again, fail, try again, fail. Finally, out to the wall comes great-granddaddy Davis, and he peeks over the wall. I mean, if you can call it that, he appears and says, "What are y'all doing down there?" I said, "Granddaddy, help." Okay, and he turns, and you can actually see him. From where we're in the creek, you can watch him walk along the wall all the way over to the fire pit and reach into that wood pile. And he got a big old stick, and he came back, and he stood next to the wall, and he reached over with his stick. It's about 2.5 feet long, and he said, "Grab on, I'll haul you out." And this 2.5-foot stick is about 32.5 feet short. I looked at Jordan, and Jordan looked at me. And in Texas, once again, seen, not heard, we didn't know how to respond and not be rude. And finally, Jordan said, I can't reach it. The truth is, it's not really an adventure until something goes wrong, right? And it remains an adventure, and you remain excited about it until you start losing hope. We've tried just about everything that we could come up with. I mean, that was, what, 3 solutions, right? And they weren't good ones, but we're getting cold, and Jordan's getting real cold, and I'm kind of trying to, like, hold him up, like, wedge my knee against the slope and, like, have him sit on it. And it's this awkward, bizarre thing with these two guys in what is literally Schitt's Creek. We were probably in there 45 minutes to an hour. And then my father and my grandfather came back from what I've always just kind of assumed was the hardware store. And these two Texas men get out of the pickup in the driveway, and they look across the backyard, and they see great-granddaddy Joe and the two girls peeking over the wall, and they rightly assume exactly what is going on. And reach into the trunk, the tailbed for the rope that exists in a Texas pickup truck. And they come on out, and I remember my dad coming up to the wall and holding the rope up over his head and saying, "What are y'all doing down there?" It was exactly like great-granddaddy. And they uncoil it, and they chuck it down, and you would think, like, oh, cool, you just grab on and haul yourself out. No. It's really hard. Best way to do this, we figured, was to wrap it a few times around Jordan, wrap it a few times around me, and both of us would just kind of hang on to the end of the rope while whoever else was up top just started walking backwards across the backyard. And that did work. That's a Texas solution, friends. We got up far enough to grab onto the trees and haul ourselves out. And, you know, ultimately, Granddaddy was a little irritated because he didn't necessarily see the difference between my mother and my uncle and my aunt when they were kids falling in that very creek and all of their friends falling in the creek, and then his grandkids all falling in the creek. To him, it was just people kept going over this damn wall and falling in the creek. It's like, I built that wall so you wouldn't do that. It took time and money, you know. And, the whole story, it blew over and it was okay, aside from a little bit of mild hypothermia, but I never really could wrap my brain. I understand why great-granddaddy went for a stick, assuming he couldn't see how far away we actually were, you know? Like, sure. But that just the whole impulse to grab a stick, especially like a brittle old one out of the wood pile, I mean, what is it going to do? And I never really understood that until just probably 6-7 years ago. I was working as an outdoor educator up in Wyoming, and we were on a backpacking trip, and I had a student fall in a river during a crossing. And I took off my backpack, and I walked down to the river trying to decide as a new instructor what do I do? And so I just went with my instinct, and I found myself grabbing for a stick. Thanks, y'all.
That story was from Landon Feller. Our next story was told by Lindsay Ross a couple years ago when she was in town for an art show. She specializes in vintage style photography, and her work is super cool. You can check it out on social media under the handle The Alchemistress. Here's Lindsay's story.
Hi, my name is Lindsay Ross. I'm a photographer. I specialize in vintage photographic processes. So basically, the story kind of begins with the fact that I've always loved having vintage cars. When I moved to California, I bought an 84 VW Rabbit that was convertible, but it actually was just, it didn't have a top. So it was the year of El Nino. I got it for like $1,000 and I drove it around rain or shine with no top. So the Rabbit was replaced when I was actually in Crestone, Colorado with the Sweetgrass Productions guys. We found a truck that was a 72 F100 that had about 1,000,000 miles on it, and it was listed for sale for $800, and they convinced me to buy it, so I took that home. So I've always loved these old cars, and I have a very loyal mechanic back in Santa Barbara who kind of understands me but yet rolls his eyes and makes snarky comments and stuff. I've been traveling so much for work. I had been driving my 72 Ford around town, and every time I went to LA, every time I went to, you know, Wyoming or here, I had to rent a car. And so my mechanic Wesley, who has a collection of cars in his yard at his family's avocado ranch, he had a 91 F-150. It was extended bed. It had a four-wheel drive. I was like, that is cool. It looks like it's from the 80s, but it, you know, works and it has everything I need. And I was like, you better have it done by the time I go to Telluride next summer, which was last year at this time. And he rushed and got it prepped for me and everything. And so I was stoked. last summer I was here shooting with the Mammoth camera that I shot this exhibition with. And I was able to shoot some of the shots that were in my show this week. I had several shots from Tomboy Mind that I took last summer, one from Alta Lakes, one of Bridal Veil. So I got that project rolling, and I was on a bit of a tear last summer. I left here and I went up to California in that 91 F-150 that I thought was so cool, and because I had a commission to do with the Mammoth camera. And then my friend Nelson Parrish asked me to exhibit some work with him in Santa Barbara. So I was going to use the photos that I had taken here already of the mining ruins. And then because we were showing in California, I wanted to photograph some mining ruins in California. And you think because we had the gold rush and everything, and there's like, you know, exploration everywhere, that there's this stuff is all over. But it was really hard for me to find like a ghost town like what we have here in California. So finally, I found this privately owned property near Death Valley called Cerro Gordo Mine, and it is so cool. It is up this beautiful canyon. Let's say the valley by Owens Lake or whatever it is, it's all dried up now, is like 2,000 or 3,000, and the top of Cerro Gordo is at 7 or 8. And so this kind of fit into my theme. It was hot, so I needed to find something high altitude to shoot. So I leave Mendocino. I'm driving through all these mountain passes in my cool F-150 truck with my truck fully loaded down with the camera and the dark room and all the chemistry and everything. And I'm just scouting locations, and not even thinking about it, just apparently riding my brakes the whole time as I'm going through the mountains. So I find the Cerro Gordo mine, which is just like 13 miles outside of Lone Pine. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the east side of the Sierras, but I find it and I'm like, yes, this is the place. Like, they're letting me shoot here. It looks cool. There's no one else around. It's high altitude and cool enough to accommodate my chemistry, which is really fussy, so with temperature. So anyway, I'm driving down this canyon road to go meet my assistant, Macy Pryor, who actually grew up in Telluride and is lovely. And it's like sharp, you know, hairpin turns with cliffs, and it's beautiful, and there's all these places that I'm scouting and jumping out of my truck as I'm, you know, going down the canyon road just to scope it all out. And I'm really excited that I finally found a place that I could shoot. And we were supposed to shoot the next day. So anyway, I'm going down, and suddenly my brakes get kind of squishy, I'm like, oh yeah, this has happened before. Like, I'll pump the brakes, and like suddenly they're gone. Like, I don't have brakes on my truck, and I did not have it in first or whatever. And I kind of started to freak out a little bit. And yeah, I'm like trying to press on the brakes, and I'm gaining speed going down a canyon road where there's no guardrail. There's no one up there. Like, there is a caretaker at the top of Cerro Gordo. So I pull the e-brake, and that doesn't slow me down. I continue to gain speed, and I'm coming around turns, and it's getting to be a bit of a rodeo with this truck. And I'm kind of thinking, okay, I'll try to hit something, a rock. I hit a rock, and I lift off of the seat, and I realize I have no seatbelt on. So I'm driving this death trap truck down the mountain with all of my mammoth camera and all of my everything with me. And I have actually some of the work that I had shot while I was here up at Tomboy Mine in the back seat. So I lift off the seat and I think, like, okay, I have no seatbelt on. What do I do? Do I bail? Like, I'm trying to decide at what point do I bail out of this truck and like tuck and roll and watch it fly off the cliff. And there's like steep walls, and I come around a turn, and the, you know, film holder is flying out of my truck, lights are flying out of my truck, like things are breaking. And I come around a turn, and there's a gravel pile, and I just like brace myself, and I just like push against the steering wheel and crash into this gravel pile. And I get out, and I'm like, I'm okay. And I have a flat tire. I can't turn, you know, my truck is not working. And so I call my, you know, insurance, and they are trying to send a tow truck, and everybody is denying to come pick me up. So Macy, who is on her way to meet me in Lone Pine, I'm like, Macy, you've got to come up this canyon and pick me up because I can't get out. I'm like thinking, wow, like this is really living what people lived when they were up here in the 19th century. I mean, I could get eaten by animals or what. I was like trying to imagine like spending the night there by myself. So Macy comes and picks me up, thank goodness, and is so wonderful because she's able to just make me laugh for the next 2 days as we try to figure this out. What I realized when we kind of assessed the damage of all the things that had gotten broken or fallen out of my truck is that one of the plates that I shot up at Tomboy, this like perfect plate of those pylons left from a building, is cracked. It is the only piece of work that was broken. But there's all this other glass that had broken that had no photographs on it. It was like, you know, something like 6 sheets of glass broke, but several pieces were safe, and then that one just had this perfect crack through it. Luckily, I was okay. So the next day we end up shooting, and I get a couple shots up in Cerro Gordo. And meanwhile, I have a totaled truck. The frame of it is bent. It needs a full brake job. The guys in Lone Pine apparently are used to this because they're not giving me any brakes on like anything. A new tire, you know, just they were just milking it. So, but luckily, you know, nothing happened to me because no one would have found me for like 4 days up that canyon. So everything was all good, and I finished my show, and I have to rent a car to bring all of my stuff back to Santa Barbara. And so I'm a little bit in a haze staying in Lone Pine for a couple days there. I get back to Santa Barbara. I have an art show with Nelson, my friend, and it looks beautiful, but I don't sell any work. And I am also without a car. And I realize at this point that I can't keep buying these cars for like $1,000 or $2,000. I need something that is safe and reliable. So I'm looking into like car payments, and I'm like, oh gosh, this is horrible. For a couple of months, every time I have a gig, I have to rent a car to go to LA or wherever to, you know, I'm hemorrhaging money just renting cars to go to work. So I'm in Jackson, Wyoming last October, and I meet this guy who's an engineer in San Diego, and I'm showing him my work that I shot when I was here, and he's really infatuated with one of those bridal veil plates I took, and it's a 20 by 24, and I'm like, yes, it's this much, and he's like, oh, I don't think I can afford that. And then I tell him about what had happened to my car, and he's like, oh, you know, I have this electrical engineering firm in San Diego. We have a fleet of trucks. If you ever want to buy one, they're $4,000. And he and I keep in touch, and I get home, and I realize, like, oh, maybe he wants to trade me. So I email him quickly. I'm like, hey, I know you want that bridal veil photo. Why don't we do a trade? And so I had 3 of those bridal veil images And that was the first one to go. And so basically, I get on the train in Santa Barbara, and I ride down to San Diego, and I've got the plate. And he picks me up from the train station, and I go and I install it in his beautiful office with all these people, you know, engineers around or whatever. And I drive away in my 2008 F-150 that has, like, you know, is safe, and it has locks that work and, you know, brakes and everything. And so, needless to say, I've been really diligent about keeping up on my truck, you know, maintenance and having my mechanic come and look at it regularly. I just didn't know your brakes could go out like that. So now I'm really conscious of it. So yeah, so that's the story.
That was Lindsay Ross. Our final story today comes from Tatiana Armstrong, a local graphic designer. She came to me with this story, and we didn't have a live theme that really fit it. So she came into the Back Pocket Creative Studio and recorded it with me. Here it is.
We're rolling. In 2013, I was a sophomore in college, and I was going home for summer break. And I had been given the opportunity to work at a very, very high-end restaurant in my hometown of Aspen, Colorado. And this was the kind of restaurant that was 5 stars and 4 diamonds. The only reason we didn't have another diamond was because we didn't wear white gloves while serving. And so, kind of a big deal. And a friend's dad had reached out for me so that I could get the job and didn't have to be actually trained in college as a server. So this job started a little later than most people for me because I really, really wanted to go on a Lake Powell trip. In college, I was part of a club, and I firmly believe that if you are in college and not in a club, you're not reaching the full potential of your money. And so we figured out a way to exploit our student club system to get $20,000 a year for a group of climbers. And if you know climbers, they don't need $20,000. So we would spend all of that money at the end of the year on a huge Lake Powell trip, renting a houseboat and stuffing 30 or 40 kids on a boat for a week and just party barging around the lake. And a little backstory on me, I wouldn't say I'm the biggest partier ever. I think when people call me a wild child, they're more talking about being outdoors than doing drugs or hanging out. But this felt like a crew that I was solid in and was definitely going to experiment with and kind of explore what we could during this giant trip. So I had the time of my life, I'll say that much, and definitely couldn't have taken one more day of it, and went home and went to start my job a few weeks late at this fancy restaurant. And so I walked in HR office and filled out all my paperwork, and as I was about to walk out onto the floor in my new crisp tie, the HR lady said, "There's one more thing, your application was flagged to take a drug test." And this is Aspen Skiing Company that owns the restaurant. So they own a few hotels, 4 ski mountains, have hundreds of employees up and down the valley, from ski patrollers to lift operators to people cleaning the rooms to the lowly college kid coming back from a Lake Powell trip. And I am the one out of 500 employees that's getting this test done. So I immediately freaked out. This was because Aspen's a small town, so news would travel very fast. And my dad had actually been an employee for SkiCo for over 35 years as well. So I pretty much knew everyone I was going to come in contact with for this process. The lady had said that the HR office where the drug test would be taken was about a 15-minute drive, and it was about 4:30, so I had a very limited amount of time to get across town. And in a moment of panic when she said, "Can you do it tonight? Or does tomorrow work better?" I just said, yeah, tonight's fine, trying to play it cool, which I realize should have bought myself a little more time. But I swiftly ran out to my car, got on my phone, and started calling every friend I could think of that probably hadn't smoked weed in their sophomore year of college. Unfortunately, a few of those friends didn't answer or were not there. But luckily, one of my greatest friends, who we call Chubby, answered the phone. And we hadn't spoken in a few months because we'd gone to different colleges. But she was excited to hear from me and then realized the panic in my voice when I said,
"What are you doing right now?"
She said,
"No, I'm just watching TV with my little sister."
And I said,
"Cool, pee in a bag and bring it out and I'll be outside in 5 minutes."
And she laughed and hung up the phone. And I hoped that she was taking me seriously as I drove over. So I got outside and she walks down the stairs carrying a brown paper bag at arm's length out to my car, hands it to me, shakes her head and says, "I don't want to know," and turns away and goes back inside while I rush across town. I was all the while thinking, okay, I have this clean pee, that's helpful. Now what do I do with it to get it inside of this testing room? And I had no idea what they were testing for, how they were doing it, if someone was going to be in the room with me, or I know that temperature was a factor too. And so I briefly considered whether I could fit a Ziploc bag in a very secretive place, and then decided that if that popped, that would be a really bad decision. So just put it in my bra. And I think my nervousness and the heat just coming off of my body probably kept it at internal body temperature for the time that it took me to get from my car up to the testing room. The lady at the testing room was actually one of my dad's friends. So she was like, "Oh, hey, how's it going? This will be easy and painless." And I was just thinking, you have no idea. And I was so nervous that I actually did pee, but I saved a lot of Chubby's pees just to pour into the cup myself and stared at it, hoping it was going to work. Realized I had a dripping Ziploc of pee that I now had to put back in a pocket or into a purse or somewhere to walk outside, and handed her my little cup. And I guess the results were instant because she said, "Cool, you're good to go." And I went straight back to work to walk into my manager, who is also a friend, staring at me blankly saying, "I can't believe you came back," because I feel like he knew that there was no way I was going to pass that test. And for the rest of the summer, I think a lot of the other waiters and waitresses in that place kind of thought I was a goody two-shoes who wasn't going to have any fun with them. But I had passed the test, and I made the money and the dignity back that I needed for that summer to move into my final years of college unharmed and unmarked as a clean drug test taker.
That story came from Tatiana Armstrong. Well, that wraps up episode 3 of the Download Podcast. I promise it won't be so long before you hear from me again. This show is brought to you by Telluride Theater, Telluride Magazine, and Back Pocket Creative. Our theme song is by Porch Couch. For information about our upcoming live events, you can follow us on Facebook, the Telluride Download, or you can visit TellurideTheater.org. If you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, email Jenny Page at jenny@telluridemagazine.com. I'm Laura Shawnette, and I'll be back soon with the Download.